Kim Adonizio has been called one of our nation's most provocative and edgy poets. Her latest books are Lucifer at the Starlight, a finalist for the Poets Prize and the Northern California Book Award, and Ordinary Genius, a guide for the poet within, both from W.W. Norton. Her novel in verse, Jimmy and Rita, was recently reissued by Austin State University Press. Kalima Press published her selected poems in Arabic. Adonizio's many honors include a Guggenheim, two NEA fellowships, and Pushcart prizes for both poetry and the essay. Her collection, Tell Me, was a National Book Award finalist. Other books include two novels from Simon & Schuster, Little Beauties and My Dreams Out in the Street. Adonizio offers private workshops in Oakland, California and online, and often incorporates her love of blues harmonica into her reading. Sounds very interesting. Kim, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Fantastic.
Okay, let's start by talking about Lucifer at the Starlight. It seems to have a lot of themes in your first book, or your first books, I should say, especially Tell Me, which I thought, by the way, was a fantastic book, and I taught it in one of my my poetry classes. It seems to have more of a reach. It seems to have more of an ambition to go beyond the smoky bar room or the relationship. It seems to go a little bit omniscient and global. Is that a fair thing to say about this book?
Yeah, I think that concern has kind of been there from the beginning through all my books. Tell
right.
Me was my third book. You know, I think that's a thread that's been there all along, really. But I think I was looking for new ways to write as well. You know, just to sort of broaden my own aesthetic and my own ability to go places. You know, I found I could write a certain kind of poem, and once I could do it, I wanted to do something else.
Yeah, maybe that's a better way of stating it, because you're right, that reach has always been there. But in this one, I just find that some of the poems are, I'm really into this omniscient voice that you're doing, like, for example, in the tsunami poem. Is this something that comes easy for you?
I don't know. You know, poems just, sometimes they're easier and sometimes they're harder. And it's, you know, it's hard to know. Whatever comes in is sort of what what I'm thinking about at the time. And I don't know, really. It's hard to answer that question, really, of whether it comes easily or not. I mean, poetry is always a challenging art.
And do you find now that you've been writing, you know, you've been writing for a while, you're an established poet, do you find that the poetry gets easier or harder, or easier in some ways or harder in some ways?
Well, I think it's always hard to wrestle a poem down to the mat and pin it and, you know, make sure it doesn't get up again. Just kind of, you know, getting it right is always, always difficult. That doesn't get any easier. But, you know, because I have been writing a long time now, I think my early drafts come out more realized than they did before. So there is that where once I get something going, a lot of it has already happened in my head or happened somewhere in my brain, you know, that has already absorbed a lot of tools and a lot of techniques and a lot of other poems. And, you know, the more of that I have in my brain, the more my brain kind of goes to work on some level that I'm not even aware of, you know, as I'm writing. So I think that, you know, has happened more so that just all that I've read and assimilated, even though I have a terrible memory and can't remember a lot of it, I've realized that something in my brain is paying attention and picks things up and organizes them at some subconscious level that I can't even access, you know.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of, like, I know this kind of, maybe this is a weird analogy, but it's like martial arts. If you study forms in martial arts, suddenly when you're in a situation where you need it, it just comes naturally. You don't even have to think about it. It becomes intuitive. And the more you learn, the more intuitive it becomes. Did it take you longer to write earlier books than it did this one?
Yeah. My first book took quite a long time. I started writing poetry at about the age of 28, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And my first book came out when I was 40.
Wow.
So that took quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, after that, it seems like every maybe 3 years I end up with a book of poems or enough poems for a book. I'm really trying to take my time with the latest one and really let it settle and not rush anything. And I'm well along in a sixth book of poems, but I don't want to rush anything. You know, I want to just give it the time it needs to, right, to develop and be what it can be.
Do you write every day, Kim?
I don't. Right now I'm on a writing retreat in Phoenix. I'm house-sitting with another poet for a month,
wow,
and we're both here writing. And so here I'm writing just about every day. At home, it just depends on what else I have to do in my life.
Do you?
But I write often, yeah.
Because you teach as well, don't you?
Mm-hmm. I mostly teach privately. I have an online poetry workshop that I do on the Internet, and I do a couple classes in my house in Oakland. This fall, I'll be the visiting writer at San Jose State, but mm-hmm, mostly I don't teach in the university. I teach privately.
You know, that's one of the things I've admired about your career, you know, from a distance, is how you really don't have to take the job, you know, that you could make a living off your writing, in a sense. Yeah, it's supplementing it here and there. I think that's like the writer's dream. Do you sometimes just think about, oh my gosh, how lucky you are, how wonderful your career seems to be going?
I think about how lucky I am every day in every way. Yeah, I'm incredibly lucky to do this, and it took me a long time to do it, and
yeah,
I sacrificed a certain amount of economic, both money and security.
Right.
You know, I've been paying my health insurance just about my entire life on my own.
Right.
So there's definitely been sort of economic choices that I made, and I made the choice not to try to teach in a university and become a tenured professor. And I chose deliberately not to go that route because I wanted to write more than anything, and I was really afraid that if I got into a university system, I would find myself with no time to write,
right,
and spend all my time trying to deal with, you know, academic things and committees and the kinds of things that other people that I knew were dealing with as writers in the university. So
yeah,
I just said, I need to be an artist. And not that people teaching in universities are not artists.
Oh, you know,
but by any means.
But yeah, but we do have a lot of stuff to do that takes us,
yeah,
away from our writing, that's for,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, so that was my first priority. That was just always my first thing, was that I had to write. And I'm very lucky that it has worked out, that I'm able to have the time to really devote to my writing. And then I also teach, and I love teaching, and I devote a lot of time to my teaching, too. But I'm just really fortunate that I was able to do that. And if not, I think I would probably be, right now, I would either be teaching English overseas or being a fine dining waitress. I think those are the two things that I, you know, that might give me time or,
yeah,
feed my writing in other ways.
Are you working on any fiction projects right now, Kim?
Fiction, yeah. I'm finishing a collection of stories, short stories, actually.
Oh.
It's a collection I had put together originally when I first went out to publish my first novel. You know, I was also trying to sell this story collection with it, and a couple of publishers wanted the novel and the stories. But Simon & Schuster, which ended up publishing the novel, did not want the stories.
Mm.
So that book was sort of abandoned. And I think with good reason. When I went back to it, I realized it wasn't strong enough. And then last year, I was on a writing fellowship, and I thought I was going to be writing poems, and instead I started writing stories again. So I've sort of taken that old collection and, you know, cut out the stuff that didn't feel very good,
mm-hmm,
or interesting, and have been writing new stories. So that's been really fun to go back to writing stories again.
And you also have two immensely popular books about poetry itself, The Craft, The Life. You have A Poet's Companion, which you co-wrote with Dorianne Locks, and everybody uses that in their poetry classes. I see that book everywhere.
Yeah. A lot of students have used it, and people have used it in their college and community college classes. It's been great.
And you also have Ordinary Genius, which you wrote on your own and which is also immensely popular. How did these books come about?
Well, as I said, I love teaching, and I'm always really interested in how to teach writing and how you learn to write, and wonder, you know, well, how did I learn to write? You know, because I just really started with no background in writing, and, you know, I always read a lot as a kid, but they were fiction books, and, you know, novels, and
and
so when I came to poetry, I was brand new to it, and I had no idea what to do or what to read or any of that. And so I think I've always been interested, especially in people who are just coming to poetry and learning about it, learning to read it, learning to write it. And Dorianne and I were doing some teaching together in the Bay Area when she lives there, and we sort of decided that we would stop Xeroxing everything all the time and try to kind of put it together into a book. you know, put a book together of what we had been teaching on these sort of weekend classes that we would do just in the community. So that's how the Poets' Companion got started. And then 10, 15 years later, I had been teaching all that time, and I was still interested in teaching writing and how to learn to write. So I wrote Ordinary Genius, which is, I think, in a way, maybe the Poets' Companion on mushrooms. I thought of it as a more, in some way, a complement to the Poets' Companion, but also, you know, a book for people who want to learn to write, or people who are writing and need some inspiration, or people who want to take their writing into performance or into collaboration with other artists, something on, you know, there are ideas in there about making broadsides and making a movie of your poem and kind of taking poetry and expanding it in other ways into the world. And Ordinary Genius has some canonical poems in it, whereas The Poet's Companion just had contemporary work. Mm. And this time I wanted to say, it's all poetry. Right. It's all part of poetry. And go ahead and read Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn next to a Dennis Johnson poem, you know, or a Marilyn Nelson poem. And it's all poetry, and it's all of a piece. And I kind of wanted that to be the case this time also, to just invite people in. That's really what both those books are about. They're saying, come on in, it's a great party, and come and write and read, because it's an amazing world of ideas and an emotion.
Who were the first poets that really inspired you and wanted to make you become a poet?
I think I was probably reading some Plath when I first sort of had that amazing feeling that you get. But I do remember reading Howell when I was 20 and being really amazed by that. I remember reading Walt Whitman and just feeling somehow so connected, because he was talking to me, even though I wasn't alive yet. And I love that feeling that he was talking about the people who were going to come after him and who would read his words. And here I was, one of those people he had imagined while he couldn't possibly imagine me.
You know, I felt the same way about Whitman. Tell me, what's your relationship to Dickinson?
I love Dickinson. I love Dickinson. I came to her later. I found her so magical. And what fascinates me is you take Whitman and Dickinson, the two biggest poets of the 19th century,
right,
and how incredibly different they are.
They're going in opposite directions.
And yet they're going to the same place. And I think that's really wonderful that poetry can get there in so many different ways. And the way, you know, poetry now, there's so many different ways of making a poem and so many different kinds of poetry out there. And I just think it's beautiful how many ways people are doing the same thing, which is just expressing what it means to be alive and expressing the spirit and trying to connect with other people and trying to understand the suffering in the world and what we can do about it, and is celebrating, you know, all the things that there are to celebrate. And so I just love that there's so many ways to do it. And Whitman and Dickinson are just, you know, you look at them and yeah, they're going in opposite directions in some ways, but in another sense, they're just side by side.
I turn to Whitman a lot, and recently, though, I've turned to Dickinson, and I just find her amazing, and something that I didn't see in her work earlier in my life, I really am now blown away by it. Maybe it took me 58 years to really understand what she's doing.
Yeah, she's not easy to understand, but she is magical, and, you know, she takes time, a different kind of time and thinking and way in, I think, than Whitman, who's so out there and so easy to sort of get hold of with all of his lists and his things of the world, and he's such a poet of the body. And Emily is such a poem of the spiritual body.
And yet you could say at once that they are both poets of desire.
Uh-huh, absolutely.
Tell me, if someone were to ask you why you wrote, it seems like such a banal question, but I think it's really an important question. Could you answer that question?
Oh, God. I mean, it is something that I have to do. It's my way of being in the world. You know, it's the way I process what happens to me. It's the way I discover what I think. It's the way I redress my wrongs and say, God, and open doors in my head and walk into rooms when I don't know what's in there. It's so many different things. And it's like music, you know. I play music too, and those are just my modes, you know. Language and music are the ones that come naturally to me. I have friends, you know, who paint and draw, and they can't write at all, but when they get into that medium, they are in their world. You know, I have a brother who's an athlete, and that's his medium. And I think we all sort of have those particular gifts that we're given, and if we're lucky, we find them and we develop them and we're able to really appreciate them and maybe then give something to others that they can appreciate.
We're talking to Kim Adonizio, whose latest book of poems is Lucifer at the Starlight, with W.W. Norton. Did you write this book, or did you just write poems for a while and the book happened?
Well, it came together the way all my books came together, which is first that I just write for a long time, like a year or two, mm-hmm. and put things in a folder and try not to look at them and try to forget I ever wrote them, because that's the only way I can get some objectivity on them. Then I go back and I pull out ones that interest me and I work on them, and when I start to feel like I'm reaching critical mass, which is usually around 20 to 25 poems that I feel good about, then I begin to feel that I'm working on a book. And often by then I have a name, and by then I have a sense of what some of the themes are. And so then I keep writing, but I'm also sort of in the back of my head realizing that things are going to go into a book.
Mm.
And what is that book going to be about? What are its concerns going to be? And what's going to fit? And I don't really make any decisions until much later, but like now I'm just about reaching critical mass on the next book. I know what it's called. I know what some of its themes are. So I'm still just writing, and maybe another 6 months from now I'll sit down and then do the scientific thing we all do, which is spread it all over the floor and call
it on. Exactly.
And look, I don't know of a writer who doesn't do it that way.
Denise Levertov used to do it that way too.
Yeah, and you just sort of like spread them around and look at them and try to figure out what calls to what, and then they start to kind of come together in different ways.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the title itself, Lucifer at the Starlight, where that came from?
Yeah, I wrote a poem called Lucifer in Starlight, or rather I wrote a poem called Lucifer at the Starlight as a response to a poem called Lucifer in Starlight, which is by George Herbert. And his poem is a sonnet about Lucifer coming up from hell and then being sort of beaten back down by God and the angels. And the basic message of the poem is a very religious one, that, you know, good triumphs over evil. And I read that poem and I thought, oh, well, I don't know about that. You know, I might have misspoke too. I meant to say George Meredith, very different writer,
yes.
Very different time. But George Meredith wrote a poem called Lucifer in Starlight. And after I read that sonnet and its message of good triumphing over evil, I thought, I don't think so. So I wrote my own sonnet called Lucifer at the Starlight, Starlite, you know, as in the Starlight Lounge.
Right.
And so I imagined Lucifer coming into a bar and, you know, talking about how great things are. Now he comes down to earth while the CEO, i.e. God, doesn't. And so I wrote this sonnet basically in response to George Meredith's sonnet. And that I knew after I wrote it was going to be the title of the collection. And so I structured the collection like a night at a bar. So the basic premise of the book is the devil walks into a bar.
Yeah.
So happy hour, the first section is events on the world stage that I thought would make Lucifer really happy, because they're disasters, wars and violence and all the terrible things that are happening. So the book kind of goes on from there through. Everything is sort of put in a place where I think it belongs according to those titles.
Yeah, you have Jukebox as the next section, and then, of course, the dance floor, which is a logical next section, and then I'm going to have to take your keys.
Right, last section.
Yeah. And my favorite section is actually Jukebox, because I really like that they were in some ways could be construed as songs from your jukebox, which you're kind of singing to your readers. And two of my favorite poems in the collection are back-to-back in that section, and that's Another Day on Earth and Forms of Love. And they're such different poems.
Right, yeah. I conceived of that section as sort of a series of songs or stories, you know, storytelling.
You're called an edgy poet by many, and I wanted to just tell you a little story about my dad. My dad used to listen to mariachi music, Vicente Fernandez, and anytime he would hear it, he would want to drink. And so he wouldn't allow himself to listen to that music if he knew he had to work the next day. You know, and I mean this in the most beautiful way. Every time I read your poems, I want to go to a bar.
Oh, no.
I want to sit down and have a drink. You write about better than anybody I've ever met. These one-night stands, these sitting at the bars and, you know, and all this stuff. Even this book itself is organized in that way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I guess it's not recommended as a gift for your friends in AA. Well, my dad, you know, I feel like I'm very comfortable in bars because my dad, that's when I saw him, was at the bar.
Oh.
You know, he'd go to the bar and he'd take the kids with him and we'd play the pinball machine and hang out with his friends and have, you know, Shirley Temples. And so I think there's something about being in a bar that I'm very comfortable with because it is kind of how I grew up and I very much associate it with my father
mm-hmm.
and with good memories of my father. And I think also, you know, I've had sort of a love-hate relationship with the way I'm perceived, and
right,
I think
yeah.
I often have a perverse desire to push it, just to say, fine, you're going to consider me the drinking poem? Here, I'm going to structure this book like a night at the bar. Take that.
Wow,
now, I kind
that's
of enjoy the playing with this whole idea of the confessional and the persona versus the person, and you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not a confessional poet. I'm an artist.
Right.
I often use the self, just like Cindy Sherman might. I'm interested in persona and disguise and using the confessional mode in certain ways, but I'm perfectly happy lying, and I lie often in my poems, you know, and I really consider poetry a kind of fiction.
You do kind of play with that image and almost as if, you know, you're aware of the image and kind of like, yeah, screw you in a way. This is what you expect of me. This is, you know, kind of what I'm going to mess around with. I like how you kind of, well, you put it much better than I did. But I love that picture of you on the back cover of Tell Me, where you're actually sitting at the bar. And I don't remember if you have a cigarette, but it's a great picture.
Yeah, we took that on my 45th birthday at 7:30 in the morning.
Oh, my God.
And those were the people that were there. And we came in. I came in with a photographer. I had an idea of what I wanted, you know. So we came in to set up the shot. And we said, hey, everybody, Bloody Mary's all around. You want to be in a photo shoot? And they were like, yeah, man. So those were the actual people that were in the bar on a Saturday morning.
Wow.
And they were happy to be in the photo. And it came out really well. It was really what I was aiming for.
We've been talking to Kim Adanizio on today's show of Words on a Wire. Kim, we always have a poem of the week on our show. Do you have your book in front of you, Lucifer at the Starlight?
Yeah, I do.
Can you read for us Another Day on Earth?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So here's my poem, Another Day on Earth, which I wrote after the tsunami of December 26, 2004. And I should mention there's a word in here, Akashic. The Akashic record is something that is supposed to be kind of this level of reality, of ether, that where everything that happens gets recorded, every thought, every single small thing gets recorded. And so my idea was that maybe there was an angel that had that job. And that comes into this poem, Another Day on Earth. Souls were arriving, souls were departing, amid the usual screaming and crying. A lot of drinks were being tossed back. A lot of women were thinking about their hair. People were loving the quiet as snow fell, burying the cars. More than one man was thinking about his penis. Birds were landing on statues. Birds were snapping up insects. Prisoners were tending invisible flowers in their cells. A lot of televisions were feeling vaguely spiritual. A lot of shoes were hurting. A lot of hearts had fallen from the trees and were skittering along in the wind. all the oceans suddenly realized they were one ocean, whereupon the Akashic Angel, whose job it is to record each moment's folding and unfolding, paused and went on furiously writing.
That was lovely, Kim. Thanks for reading that poem for us.
And thanks for being on Words on a Wire.
Yeah, thank you for having me.